Brethren, we have begun a series on the life of David, and today I'm going to give the second part, not the final part yet, but the second part on the series. And in the first sermon of the series, we discussed the fact that although David was a man after God's own heart, he was not perfect. He did sin, and he had to learn from his mistakes. We saw that God set in motion a law which, if violated, brings about negative consequences. And this law is the law against killing, including killing in war. We read Christ's statement to Peter, where he told him to put the sword away, because all who take the sword shall perish by the sword, unless they repent. In this series, we will show how this law was applicable in the life of David as it is today, and how David finally came to understand. We saw that Christ, who is called the Prince of Peace, will establish peace on this earth. He will not establish war on this earth. In fact, man will not learn war anymore. And David will rule in God's kingdom. He will be an immortal spirit being. He will be a God being. And so he had to learn that too. We saw how God dealt in David's life, that he allowed a demon to plague Saul in order to accomplish his purpose regarding David. We saw that through the demon's activity, Saul brought David to his court, but he also tried to kill him. We saw that David fought against the Philistines and that they had to flee from him, and that on the very same day, the demon plagued Saul so that he tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, and David had to flee from Saul. Today we'll see further evidence that the law against killing in war was in effect at David's time and how it affected his life when he violated it. But before I go on, let's not in any way condemn David, because he was a good man. He was a man after God's own heart, as we heard in the sermonettes. His heart was perfect with God, as it said, unlike the heart of his son Solomon. But he had to learn God's way of life in more and more perfect ways, as we all do, in many different ways, in many different areas of our life. You see, David grew up in a society where war was a common thing. No one in Israel questioned it, and David was affected by it. He didn't question it either until later in his life. But we are not that much different today. We too grew up and are growing up in certain societies. And we too are adopting certain human concepts which are against God's law, God's perfect will, but we may not see it yet. And even if we do, we might have a hard time getting rid of those wrong ideas. And even though we may suppress them at times, they will surface and be expressed at other times. And this doesn't only address the concepts regarding war. It goes for other aspects of life as well. For instance, Abraham never questioned the procedure of producing offspring through Sarah's maid, because this was not an uncommon procedure at the time to produce offspring that way. The ancients didn't seem to question the habit of taking more than one wife, because it was common to do so. And so we find that Jacob ended up with two wives. But this didn't work too well, did it? Now that's a different story, and we may touch upon this issue as we go through the life of David, because he too took more than one wife, but it seems he repented of it later on in his life. Today, some of us may have some wrong concepts regarding war and violence. I've talked to a minister at one time, belongs to another church organization, who believes that it is not wrong to use a gun to defend himself, to kill a perpetrator, that it's not wrong for a Christian to carry a gun as a police officer and use it, if need be. But I'm sure, at least I hope, that God will reveal the error of that concept to him in his due time, when he is ready to receive it. In the meantime, though, those of us who do understand are, of course, not to be influenced by such wrong concepts. Because God isn't giving up on us, God never gave up on David. And with patience, he taught David through the hard knots of life. David suffered a lot, but he slowly learned important lessons. Sometimes he suffered because he endured persecution when he lived righteously. Sometimes he suffered because sin brings about automatic penalties and consequences. Sometimes he suffered because God added a little bit to it to make him see. God looked at David as his son, and the father chastens every son whom he receives. Now, returning now to the episode in David's life when he fled from Saul, who had just tried to kill him with a javelin or a spear, as we read, David later wrote down his feelings he had during his flight. And if you turn with me to Psalm 59, we'll pick up the story there. Because in Psalm 59, David expresses his feelings during that time. And in my Bible, it is introduced as to the chief musician set to do not destroy a mishtam of David when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. And so it says in verse 1 of Psalm 59, deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. Notice this. David said, they lie in wait for my life, but not for my transgression, nor for my sin. And it is, of course, correct that David had not sinned against Saul. So Saul had no reason to kill David. But it didn't mean, it doesn't have to mean, that David was sinless, period. You see, it's very similar when you think in terms of Satan trying to induce God to let him persecute Job. Satan didn't give God any reason why he should persecute Job. And that's why God later says to Satan, you haven't given me any reason. But there was a reason, there was a purpose. God saw the purpose. Satan couldn't see it, because Satan had the same problem Job had, the problem of self-righteousness. But God allowed Satan to do it because he wanted Job to learn lessons from this ordeal. But we find that David, who hadn't sinned against Saul, fled to Samuel, and let's pick up the story now in 1 Samuel chapter 19. He fled to Samuel, and he dwelt with Samuel in Ramah. We find that Saul tried to capture David, but God intervened on David's behalf. Let's read it in 1 Samuel chapter 19, beginning in verse 18. It says, David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed at Naoth. Now it was told Saul, saying, take note, David is at Naoth in Ramah. And then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Then he also went to Ramah and came to the great well that is at Zichru. And so he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, indeed they are at Naoth in Ramah. So he went there to Naoth in Ramah. Then the Spirit of God was upon him also. Now notice this. This is very interesting. God had originally given Saul his spirit, but then he had taken the spirit away from him. And an evil spirit from God, a demon, came to plague Saul. And then Saul did all these crazy things. But here we see that the Spirit of God came upon him. It doesn't say it entered him. It didn't say necessarily that Saul receives the Spirit of God again, but it does say that the Spirit of God influenced Saul, this evil person, to do something. What did he do? Notice, and he went on and prophesied. Now, that should tell you something. Not every quote-unquote minister who may be giving inspired quote-unquote sermons necessarily has to be a true minister. Here Saul, that evil, rotten guy, prophesied because the Spirit of God was upon him. Of course, God allowed that for a reason. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. And notice what happened in verse 24. And also, he stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Now, you want to picture that, if you please. And therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Or maybe they said, is Saul also among the prophets? But anyway, this is an interesting little thing which is happening here. But what happened is now that David fled again. And when he met Jonathan, because Saul's son and the good friend of David's, he asked him a very pointed question in 1 Samuel 20 and in verse 1. 1 Samuel 20 and verse 1. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? Again, he hadn't done anything to Saul. Saul had no reason to do to David what he did. And when David fled from Saul, he came to Ahimelech. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I asked my daughter this morning. Maybe she told me differently, but I think it's Ahimelech. Ahimelech, so it's a priest anyway you're talking about here. And it's interesting in 1 Samuel chapter 21 what transpires. Now again, the Bible just reports what happens. You and I, with God's Spirit, are supposed to understand that what David did here was wrong. Notice 1 Samuel 21, beginning in verse 1. And David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? So David said to Ahimelech, the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I sent you or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men in such and such a place. See, that was all a blatant lie. Saul had not commanded him on a business at all. Now, therefore, verse 3, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women. Then David answered the priest and said to him, truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessels this day. And so the priest gave him holy bread. And there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now, that aspect of it, Christ would later comment on. And he would say that David didn't sin when he ate from the showbread. But Christ, of course, didn't comment on the story which David fabricated here. And the same is pretty much true when you think in terms of what Rahab did. I mean, Rahab was applauded for the fact that she saved the spies, but God did not endorse her lying in the process. Verse 7. The story doesn't end here. Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg in Edomite, a modern Turk, if you please, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. Well, he was an ancient Turk. I mean, the Edomites, of course, you know, having developed into the Turks today. And David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. Again, keeps up that story. So the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it. For there is no other except that one here. And David said, there is none like it give it to me. Now what do we see? We see that David takes the sword again. And of course, before someone can take or use the sword, he must have a sword. Well, David didn't have a sword. You know, he fled from Saul. And so the priest ignorantly offers the sword of Goliath, which what had been preserved to him. And David takes it. Now what did Christ say? Whoever takes the sword shall perish by the sword, unless, as we seen last time, the person repents. I'd like to point out here that before you can use a sword, you must have a sword. Now keep your finger here, and let's go quickly to a scripture in the New Testament, in the book of Luke chapter 22, because here we find something interesting developing between Christ and the disciples, especially Peter. In Luke chapter 22 and in verse 36, Christ is telling the disciples. He said to them, Luke 22 and in verse 36, "But now he who has a money bag, let him take it, likewise a knapsack, and he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you that this which is written must still be accomplished in me. And he was numbered with the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end." And so they said, "Lord, look, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough." Now that seems to be a strange statement by Christ, given the fact that he had so clearly preached against killing or even hating another person, including one's enemies. Now, but let's see what Christ said in verse 37. He said, "The things written about me must be accomplished," and the thing which he specifically makes reference to is, he was numbered with the transgressors. Now, we have already discussed that when later Peter took his sword, the one he apparently just bought, Christ commanded him to put it away. Therefore, Peter had to buy a sword first in order to have it, in order to be able to use it, thereby transgressing God's law against killing. You see, Christ was numbered with the transgressors, Peter and the other disciples, because they had a sword willing to use it. The point is, going back to 1 Samuel, that when David took Goliath's sword, he was willing to use it too. And now we should already expect problems developing from that, and they in fact do develop. In 1 Samuel 21, and in verse 10, the story goes on to say, "Then David arose," 1 Samuel 21 and verse 10, "and fled that day from before Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath." Now notice this. He takes the sword, and immediately he got to flee because Saul is after him. But you see, this David also went his reputation as a mighty warrior. And so we read in verse 11, "And the servants of Achish said to him, 'Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? Verse 12, "Now David took these words to heart, and he was very much afraid of King Achish, that king of Gath." Afraid that this king might want to use him as a warrior, perhaps, in his own army, or that he might revenge himself for the death of the man David had killed in his prior pursuits, look what David does. Verse 13. "So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gates, and let his saliva fall down on his beard." Now that's not a pretty sight, is it? Here we see, perhaps ironically, what the reputation of a great warrior can do to such a man in certain circumstances. But we also see that David, through his conduct, misrepresented, because he wasn't mad. He wasn't mad at all. He feigned madness. He pretended that he was insane because he was afraid, what would this king do to him now after he found out that he was this great warrior? And so verse 14, then the king said to his servants, look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? And so we find that David departed from this city, and now he became a captain of about 400 men. But notice in 1 Samuel chapter 22, beginning in verse 1, how those people are described. David therefore, 1 Samuel 22 and verse 1, David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. Now, apparently, they joined this David, which is interesting because there was this time where the brothers belittled David. He had come down, you know, to look at Goliath, and they said, why did he come down here? You just came down in order to see the battle. And so they weren't all that happy with David, plus which, you know, David was chosen to be the king, but Samuel, not them. But they still come down to apparently join with him. But now notice also verse 2. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented, or as it says in the margin, bitter of soul, gathered to him. And so he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. So the people who gathered with him were not the most happiest people they were. They didn't have a necessarily extremely positive outlook on life either. They were distressed. They were discontented. They were bitter of soul. And it would be those people David would have to use to fight the Philistines. These were the kind of people David was associating with. Later we find that they had sometimes some very bad influence on him. But now, before addressing this account in 1 Samuel 23, where he and these men fight the Philistines, let's first of all go back and take note of David's reaction to what Saul did to the priests. And that, of course, is recorded in 1 Samuel 22. We are being told that Saul had found out that the priest Ahimelech had given David to eat when he fled from Saul. Of course, he didn't know that Saul was trying to kill David, because, as you recall, David had told him that he was on a secret mission from the king. So the priest did it innocently, ignorantly. He believed the lie David had told him. But nevertheless, Saul became angry, and he ordered all the priests to be killed. But one of Ahimelech's sons escaped, and he told David about the slaughter. Now notice David's response in 1 Samuel chapter 22 and in verse 22. So David said to Abiathar, that's the one who escaped, the only one who survived, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. How did he cause the death of all the persons of the priest's house? Well, he caused the death because he deceived the priest, and he, through his lie, of course, prompted the priest to give him to eat, and of course, in Saul's eyes, that was tantamount to treason on the priest's side, or priest's behalf. But what he probably didn't realize then was the fact that his lie, when he lied to the priests, was a consequence of his fleeing from Saul, which was a consequence of his fighting with the Philistines. See, one thing led to the next in this process, ending up in the slaughter of all the priests through Saul. And Saul killed the priest when he heard that Ahimelech had given David not just only bread, but something else. Notice it in verse 10, 1 Samuel 22 and verse 10. This is a report which is being given, and it says in verse 10, and he inquired of the Lord for him. This is what Doeg tells Saul. And this priest now gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. And notice also in verse 13 of the same chapter, then Saul says to him, why have you, and now he's talking to the priest, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day? Saul, of course, thought, although this was an error, that David would use the sword against him. Now, as we will see, David never did use the sword against Saul, but the fact that he took the sword of Goliath was a contributing factor to the murder of the priests through Saul. You see how this law is in motion. Take the sword, you'll perish by it. And of course, the implication is you take the sword for the purpose of killing other human beings. But if we go now to 1 Samuel 23, we read that David and his men fought against the Philistines. And when we glance at this account, as some unfortunately have done, we might conclude that David was only fulfilling God's purpose. He was only fulfilling God's will. He was only heeding the commandment of God. He was only obeying God. So what was wrong for David to do what he did in 1 Samuel chapter 23? Well, let's read the account carefully. 1 Samuel 23, beginning in verse 1. Then they told David, saying, look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, and they are robbing the threshing floors. And therefore David inquired of the Lord, saying, should I go and attack these Philistines? And the Lord said to David, go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah. So again, didn't he ask God? And didn't God tell him to do it? But let's notice what David asks. Is David asking God, shall I continue to fight in war, period? That's not the question he asks. He asked the question, shall I fight this particular battle? Shall I go down to attack the Philistines to save Keilah? That's the question he had asked. David wasn't asking the question, that didn't even enter his mind yet, whether fighting in war was right or wrong. Rather, David wanted to know whether he should fight this particular battle. And the reason why he even asked this question becomes very clear when we read on, beginning in verse 4. Now, let's start reading in verse 3. But David's men said to him, look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines? And then David inquired of the Lord once again. And the Lord answered him and said, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into your hands. And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, and took away their livestock. And so David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. The problem here, if you don't read this carefully, is the assumption that David did, in the ultimate sense, what was right and good in God's eyes. But that's an assumption. If you think in terms of what happened with Micah, Micah saw in a vision all the spirit beings assembled in front of God's throne because God wanted a particular king. I believe it was king. It is similar what's happening here with David and Keilah as what happened with a situation developing in the book of Micah when Micah saw a vision, and in a vision all the spirit beings appeared in front of God before his throne, and God wanted to see that one particular king, I believe it was King Ahab, would have to be defeated. And he said, well, what are we going to do about this? And some angel said this, and some angel said that, and then a spirit, it says, in all likelihood a demon, stepped forward and said, I can do it, because I will become a lying spirit in the mouth of all the prophets. And God said, go ahead and do it, and it will be, you will be successful. You see, that spirit being had already made up his mind what he wanted to do. God still says, go ahead and do it. But God did not prompt him to lie, as God didn't prompt David to fight this battle. David asked the question. It wasn't the time yet for David to understand. That would come later, that he shouldn't even go to battle, period. But so God just used David, who was willing to do it in general terms anyhow, to fight this particular battle. Because David was still for war, generally speaking. It wasn't God telling him to go to war. It was David who had decided that it was right for him to go to war, and he just wanted to know, should I fight this particular battle? And God wanted the city of Keilah to be saved. He used David for the accomplishment of that purpose. You see, it wasn't God's time yet to tell David war is wrong, because David wouldn't have understood that yet. He had to learn this by experience. Sure, if he had told him, no, don't fight, David wouldn't have fought. I'm sure of that. He would have obeyed God. But you see, it's one thing to just obey a command. It's another thing to understand why that command should be obeyed. And that is what God wanted David to understand. That is what God wants all of us to understand today in so many different ways. Sure, many times when we see something in the Bible, although we may not understand it yet, we still have to obey. That's clear. Mr. Armstrong had to do that. He kept the feast days for many, many years before he understood the purpose. But nevertheless, what God is really interested in is that we also understand, because of the love of God in us and for his law, why we do what we do, because that would be the only guarantee then that we never sin against those laws, because we understand the validity and the great magnificent wisdom expressed in God's law. But now let's keep reading here and see what happened next. In verse 8, Then this happened, when David took over the city, then Saul called all the people together for war. Immediate consequence, to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. So what we see here is that David, the warrior, is threatened with war. And so he asks God again in verse 10 of chapter 23. David said, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the man of Keilah deliver me into his hands? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. And then David said, will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will deliver you. Now David found out that the people whom he had saved through war would deliver him to the warrior Saul. And amazingly, God would let that happen. But he could have prevented Saul from coming down in the first place. He could have prevented the men of Keilah to act the way they would have acted. In other words, he could have given them a heart of thanks towards David, so that they would not deliver him to Saul, but God didn't. You see, he wanted to show David something. And these are little pieces which are being put together here in David's life, piece by piece, until finally a whole picture would emerge so that David could understand. He wanted to show David that war never brings about peace, happiness, tranquility, or even genuine friendship. And history has proven that. History is proving that right now. The allies of today are the enemies of tomorrow. I just finished a program on the Standing Watch series on allies, enemies, and you, talking about some of these things, how at one time the United States had friends in certain parts of the world who have now turned or are turning to become the enemies. See, war never produces genuine friendship. And David had to learn this here and find this out the hard way. And so we find now in verse 13 what he does. Verse 13 of 1 Samuel 23. So David and his men, about 600, now they had 600 men now, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition. Let's keep reading then in verse 14. And David stayed in strongholds in the wilderness and remained in the mountains of the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but now notice, but God did not deliver him into his hands. Now he doesn't, but he would have if he had stayed in Keilah. What does this episode tell us? It tells us that when David avoided war, when he fled from his enemy, God intervened and protected him. And we also find a little later in verse 26 of the same chapter. Saul went on one side of the mountain and David on and his men on the other side of the mountain. And so David made haste to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were encircling David and his men to take them. But now notice what happened in verse 27. But a messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land." And therefore Saul returned from pursuing David and went against the Philistines, and so they called that place the Rock of Escape. What does the Bible say? No temptation, no trial has overtaken you, but it's coming to man. But God is going to provide the way of escape for those who love him, for those who do the things which are pleasing in God's sight. It was very pleasing in God's sight what David did here. Tried to escape, tried to not get involved in warfare with Saul. And as a consequence, God intervenes. And he, the way it is kind of reported here, must have influenced the Philistines to invade the land. So Saul had to leave and had to draw and had to look, you know, very carefully as to what to do with the Philistines. And so he stopped pursuing David's. So we again see here the second time that God intervened on David's behalf. When David avoided war, when David made haste to get away from his enemy. But let's go back now again to the incident when David fought the Philistines to save Keilah. Because we might still wonder how David could have sinned in this incident when God told him to attack that city, or rather the enemy of the Philistines. So in other words, let me ask the question again. How could David have sinned when God told him to attack his enemy? Well, this question was asked and answered, this kind of question, in regards to the nation of Israel. I have here in front of me the booklet Military Service and War, written by Mr. Armstrong, and I have the 1985 edition. And let me just read to you from pages 28 and 29, something which is very important and critical to understand. And I dare to say before I go on that ministers in the different churches of God do not understand this, have specifically refused to accept this, and have thereby totally misunderstood even what the Bible teaches us regarding the life of David. So let me read now from page 28 and page 29 of the booklet Military Service and War. Here Mr. Armstrong is asking the same question, the question I just asked. If war is wrong, if it is sin, if it is contrary to God's way for man, then why did God on occasion actually order the Israelites to go to war and to kill? Consider these two facts. One, Israel had sinned in little a, not trusting God to do the fighting for them, and little b, in disobeying God's commandment against war. They had chosen to be a war-waging nation. The decision was wrong. Yet God compels man to decide whether to sin. If he does, he brings on himself the penalty. The fact, therefore, must be realized that Israel refused to rely on God to do the fighting and chose to be a warring nation. Two, God's purpose must stand regardless of what men do. It was God's purpose to install Israel in and to drive certain people out of God's holy land, which he had promised the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Since Israel was not going to rely on God to drive out these nations, but elected to be a war-making nation, God used them to accomplish his purpose of exterminating these land poachers. Therefore, he ordered them to do what was required to make his purpose stand. And a little later he says, because of Israel's faithlessness and disobedience, God used them as his instrument in taking life, which God had the full right to do. Because my comment, after all, he is the one who creates life, so he is the only one who has the right to take it. He goes on to say, Israel had chosen the way of sin in going to war. Even then, they could have changed their decision. Close quote. Well, how does this apply to David? Now, let's remember. David grew up in a war-raging nation. David assumed that it was God's will for man to fight in war. He didn't understand the full meaning of God's commandments against war. In effect, of course, he sinned when he went to war. Let me read to you from the same booklet, from page 30, where Mr. Armstrong writes this. David was a warrior. David killed many people. As king, he waged war. But that did not make war right. God held David accountable for his blood guiltiness. And as we go through the series, we will see this more and more. Samson goes on to say, David was a man after God's own heart, not because of his wars, his fighting, his killing. God punished him for that. Close quote. Going back to Keilah, we find that it was obviously God's will to save that city. David had chosen to be a warrior. David had chosen to fight in war. So God used him as his instrument to accomplish his purpose. But I'm saying this, Mr. Armstrong, that didn't make that war right. But David had to learn that. And so his life, he would. To go on with the story then, when Saul returned from following the Philistines, he went again against David with 3,000 chosen men from Israel. David had, what did you say, 600, 800? It's then recorded that Saul went into a cave to attend his need. So let's read that story in 1 Samuel 24, beginning in verse 1. And as I said, all these episodes are little pieces of experiences in David's life which formed and created a picture which he finally understood. 1 Samuel 24, verse 1. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. And so he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And Saul went in to attend to his needs. You know, of course, he went to the restroom, if you would say, today, except there wasn't one, so he went into that cave. But David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave, so they were right there, all his men. David and all the men were there when Saul came in alone to attend to his needs. Now notice verse 4. Then the men of David said to him, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hands, that you may do to him as it seems good to you. What they were actually saying, and later it's clarified, kill him. Chop his head off. God has delivered him into your hands. David didn't do that, but David did do something. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, in David's mind, he followed the advice of his men, those discontented men we read about earlier, to an extent. He followed that bad advice to an extent. Now, he didn't kill him, of course, but in his mind, cutting off a piece of Saul's robe was to an extent tantamount to lifting his hand against the king. Because the following verse proves that. Verse 5. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him, because he had cut Saul's robe. Why would his heart trouble him unless there was something in his mind which was tantamount to somehow lifting his hand against Saul the king. And of course, when it says the heart troubled him, what it means is that God's spirit in him made him feel guilty. So he did something which didn't coincide with what he should have done. And then he goes on to say, in verse 6, and he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. Now, he was the anointed of the Lord because Samuel had anointed him to be king. Because in the meantime, Samuel had also anointed David to be king, but David hadn't put into the office yet. He had to wait, of course, until Saul would die. And this is something we read later in the book. Let me also say that some have appropriated that title to themselves today. And there is nothing in the Bible which remotely would suggest that any minister should call himself the anointed of the Lord. That is just a misappropriation. And nothing in the New Testament remotely suggests that. There's only two in the Old Testament who are referred to as the anointed of the Lord, and these are the two witnesses. Well, unless you feel that you are one of the two witnesses, you'd better not use that title. It goes on to say in verse 7, so David restrained his servants with those words and did not allow them to rise against Saul, and Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. But after this, David calls out to Saul, explaining to him in verse 10, he says, look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. See, David understood what they were telling him. You know, God has delivered them into your hands, do with him what you please, so kill him. He goes on to say, but my eyes spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for it's the Lord's anointed. Moreover, verse 11, my father, see, now of course he was the son-in-law, Saul was his father-in-law. You know, he had given him his daughter, but then when he had to flee, when David had to flee, then Saul gave the daughter to somebody else. So David calls him my father. See, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hands, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand to the point of killing him. But still, since his heart troubled him, taking this piece from the robe was already something David felt he shouldn't have done. He goes on to say, and I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it. Now, as I was stressing before, David had not sinned against Saul. However, David seems to say here, looking at the context, that if he had killed Saul, he would have sinned against him. David, in calling Saul his father, as I explained, you know, he was his father-in-law, emphasizes that his hand will not be against him. And he goes on to say in verse 12 what he feels should happen. He says, let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As a proverb of the ancients says, verse 13, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue, a dead dog, a flea? Therefore let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case, and deliver me out of your hands. Now he turns his life totally over to God in this incident. He says, well, God is going to plead my case. God will avenge me. I will not do it. God will deliver me out of your hands. I will not raise my hand against you. Now, it's interesting here to see Saul's change of attitude, which was obviously brought about by God at this moment in time. I want to turn the time right, it takes the time right now to turn to Proverbs 16 verse 7, but you may want to jot this down and read it later. Because in Proverbs 16 and verse 7 you read, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And here we see a totally different attitude now developing in Saul. And what do we read beginning in verse 16? And so it was, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, Is this your voice, my son, David? As I said, he was his son-in-law. And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And then he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you didn't kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? Therefore may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hands. And therefore swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. And David swore to Saul, and he would keep that promise, as the later record reveals. And Saul went home, didn't finish or didn't continue pursuing David, and David and his men went up to the strongholds. Now, I received an interesting memo the other day from somebody, and I thought he had a very good point, which I'd like to share with you at this moment, because remember, we had read in verse 12 that the Lord, David said, the Lord shall judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you. Now, of course, a scripture which comes to mind here is Romans chapter 12 and verse 14, which says, bless those who persecute you, bless and curse not. And it goes on to say, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay. Now, that's understood, but the memo which I received the other day makes the following interesting point. This author is saying, what struck me about this verse is that vengeance is something that God owns. It is His, not mine. I don't know why this idea of ownership seemed very powerful to me, but it did. I cannot take God's tithe. He owns it. And I cannot take vengeance. He also owns it. It's not my place to take what is His. I thought it was a very important and interesting concept. You know, you take vengeance upon yourself, you are stealing from God what is His. On top of the fact that you shouldn't do it anyway, because God is the one who will take care of that. Now, David understood this in this particular incident. He didn't understand it always. I'm not entirely sure where we are time-wise, how many hours I still got. Mr. Willis is looking at his watch and tells me that I have, 5 minutes? Or 35 minutes? I still have 35 minutes? Wow, great. Okay, let's keep going. I can't believe I have 35 minutes, but that's good. I'm happy. I'm all for it. What we see here from this episode is that when David seeks peace and pursues it, as we read in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 11, when he tries to become a peacemaker, as we see that in James chapter 3 and verse 18, we read that in a moment, when he tries to live peaceably and in peace, we read in 2 Corinthians, keep your finger here in 1 Samuel, in 2 Corinthians 13, what the consequence would be. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 11. Here's what Paul is telling all of us. Finally, brethren, farewell. Become complete, become perfect, go on your way to perfection. Be of great comfort, be of one mind, live in peace, and the God of love and peace will be with you. Well, the opposite may be true as well. Live in war, and the God of peace won't be with you. So David had to learn that. He also learned what is true and stated in James chapter 3 and verse 18. Notice with me, James chapter 3 and verse 18. Again, a timeless command, a timeless principle. It's not something which suddenly the New Testament came up with, which was never known in the Old Testament times. It was kind of known. It was most certainly enforced in effect. It had to be revealed. It says in James 3 and verse 18, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Peace leads to peace. War leads to war. But, you know, let's go into one more episode then, since I have all this time left. Because subsequent events show that David, although he just applied this principle towards Saul, as he was God's anointed, maybe that was the main reason why he applied it here, he didn't fully understand yet that this way of life has to be lived towards anyone and everybody, not just towards Saul, but anyone and everybody. You read in Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, and I just read this for you, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Not just with King Saul, you see. And so now we read in 1 Samuel chapter 25 about this fool, as he is called, Nabal. And we read in verse 3 that the name of the man was Nabal, that means pretty much fool, and the name of his wife was Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. What a tragedy. Remember Caleb? One of those two who went into the promised land because of his great faithfulness and his belief and trust in God. And here's his fool Nabal coming out of his house, but acting totally different from how Caleb had acted. Now, we find in this particular episode that this Nabal refused to give David's men food, although they had cared for and protected for Nabal's sheep and his shepherds. And so when he refused to kind of repay them for all the work they had done, we read David's reaction in verse 13. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. So they had about 600 men at the time. So what do? They take the swords. Now, Abigail, Nabal's wife, a woman, as we have just read, of good understanding and beautiful appearance, when she heard that David and his men were marching against Nabal, rode on a donkey. That's important, remember that. She rode on a donkey with a lot of food to David to stop him. Because what did David intend to do in verse 21? David had said, I'm reading here 1 Samuel chapter 25, in verse 21, David had said, surely, in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. Now, if you have an authorized version, see, this is a kind of a nice little translation in the New King James, which doesn't quite give the full meaning as to what David was actually saying. If you have the authorized version, that gives the literal expression, and what he is actually saying is, may God do also more also to the enemies of David, if I leave any that pisses against the wall alive. That's what he was saying. See, you could sense the rage, the anger. So he said, if I leave any of these guys alive. So that was the kind of attitude he was in when Abigail approached him. And we find that Abigail approaches David in a very diplomatic, flattering fashion. But she does get the point across. See, as I said, we can perhaps sense the wrath, the anger David had at this point in time. So Abigail fell on her face before David, and points out in verse 26, therefore, my lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself, notice, with your own hands, how did the Lord hold him back? Through Abigail's appearance. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal. goes on to say, "Now this present which your maidservant has brought to my lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my lord." Verse 28. "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant." Very interesting comment, because you see, Abigail hadn't done anything wrong. She had explained earlier, she didn't even know what was going on. She didn't know that Nabal was refusing to give food to the people. But the lady here, Abigail, is saying, "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant." So what she is doing is, she is, in a sense, adopting, taking upon herself the sin of Nabal. Very important, this aspect. It goes on to say, "For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days," at least insofar as outright rebellion is concerned. Now, David did what he did, but he did it with a good heart. He thought it was right. And so he wasn't a rebellious guy like Saul and like some of these others. Verse 29, "Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling." Verse 30, "And it shall come to pass, when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you, no offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservants." And now notice David's response in verse 32. "Then David said to Abigail, 'Blessed is the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed, and from avenging myself with my own hands. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, surely by morning light, no males," and again the same expression is used in the original, "no males would have been left to Nabal." You know, we are seeing something interesting here. We are seeing that through Abigail's intervention, David was prevented from doing some terrible things. Now, we also find, if we keep reading in verse 37, that so it was in the morning when the wine had gone from Nabal, so he was apparently at home getting drunk, and that his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. And then it happened, verse 38, after about 10 days, that the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Again, God fights David's battles, and David lets God fight his battles. The lesson we have to glean from this. And so we read in verse 39, "When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept his servant from evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own hands, on his own head.' And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife." Now, there's something interesting to be said about Abigail in this context. We read very clearly that if it hadn't been for God's intervention, David would have committed, as he himself said, evil in killing Nabal and his men. Of course, the men really hadn't done anything either. It was really the guy Nabal who was all responsible. And God used Abigail to show David that he shouldn't deal differently with a person like Nabal than how he had dealt with a person like King Saul. And what we find here about Abigail is that Abigail becomes, in this particular episode, a type, if you please, of Jesus Christ. First, she was riding a donkey. She describes herself in verse 41. It says, "She arose, she bowed her face to the earth and said, Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my lords. And certainly, as we have already seen, she kind of takes the sin which was on Nabal's head and says to David, please forgive my transgression. So she has become, in this particular episode, a type of Christ. And through the warning given to David, David could see what he was about to do was wrong and stopped from doing it. It's interesting that Christ also, later on, would stop his disciples, James and John, to do something very terrible. And you read that in the book of Luke, chapter 9, in verses 54 to 56. Luke 9, 54 to 56. Let me just read it to you. Where we read, and when his disciples, James and John, who were at the time called the sons of thunder, saw this, in other words, the Samaritans didn't want to give some shelter, and so they got all upset about that. Not very unlikely to the situation here, but David got all upset because Nabal wasn't willing to pay him for what he had done. So they were all upset about that, and they said, oh Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, do you not know what manner of spirit you are of? For the Son of Man didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And so they went into another city. And so as Jesus rebuked James and John at the time and told them that this is not what they were supposed to be doing, he used Abigail to drive this lesson home to David. And David refused then from repaying evil with evil. You know, he had repaid good, or rather evil with good, when it came to Saul. And he had to learn that he had to do the same thing when it came to this guy, Nabal. And so we have seen that David, through God's intervention, practiced the way of peace even towards his enemies, in this case Nabal, and God would take care of the situation, and God did. So when I think, now I am going to stop, and the next time we'll continue on our journey through the life of David, and hopefully we'll learn some more interesting lessons from it.